Tonight we chanted the funeral chanting for Laurel Bleece. And yeah, Laurel was a frequent visitor here, and we weren't expecting her death. And as far as I know, none of us here know anything more than that. Her partner called and left a message. And Laurel's primary contact, at least that I'm aware of, was mailing free distribution books. And part of a very small part of my job as guest monk and office monk was to allocate time on the book room computer to make sure there weren't any schedule conflicts. And Laurel would email, I think, about once every 2 or 3 weeks and say, I'm coming in at so and such a time to mail books. And I just plug that into the calendar. And yeah, she was very diligent at this. And the gift of Dhamma is considered to be the greatest of gifts, and Laura must have mailed out hundreds of Dhamma books as she came here week after week. And that's, I'm sure, been of great benefit to many people. And yeah, I hope that merit follows Laurel wherever she is. And, I didn't have too much personal contact with her, but I can certainly remember, just seeing her gentle face around and quiet presence. Not conspicuous at all, just there, present, doing good. And we've had several talks on Maran Nusati, the contemplation of death. I'm hoping not to overdo it, but at the same time, people don't stop dying simply because you've sufficiently contemplated death. It just keeps happening. And it's something, yeah, in a way, this initial period when we hear something like this, we have a habit of pushing the reflections of death away. And when we know how someone has died, we often subconsciously use that information to distance ourselves from it. For so and such a reason, I couldn't die that way. But when you don't know, there's that not knowing makes it sometimes more impact, closer. And in a way, there's something, the coroner writes something on your death certificate that says why you died, but the Buddha might say it'd be more accurate just to, on everybody's death certificate, write cause of death, birth. That's the real cause of death. I mean, there was some sort of incidental thing happened, but if you didn't die from that, it would have been something else. So there we are. Yeah, Laurel was born. Laurel died. We've been born. We'll die. And just to reflect on how, I tend to avoid that. Last night I had a fairly, odd dream where I was, we were driving up the hill in the pickup truck, and I was in the cab. One of the male retreat crew, I can't remember who, was driving. And for some reason, and I have no idea where this came from, but right at, as you make the left turn, as you make the left turn above the log cabin, this particular person put the truck cruise control on 85. And so we went, and so the truck was screaming up the hill and passing the log cabin at about 40, at 45 miles an hour. I thought, well, I'm sure he's a really good driver, but I don't think he's up for this. And so, and then I woke up and I could just, feel that, that fear of death, which I mean, I do deliberately recollect death going up and down the hill in that truck. Anyway, but, that's just a... But 85, that's too fast. So, but then what was interesting was what I did with it was that there it was, and I thought, well, I could get up and sit in meditation and contemplate this. But what actually happened was I went back to sleep. And that is just so real. Another way we cover up this fear of death is, with our accomplishments, the story of our life. And right now I'm reading the Tao of Physics, which I haven't read before. And I got to a chapter early on about the history of quantum physics, and I know much of this from my background, but just being reminded of it, it's wow, what an accomplishment. And just one that stood out was I've forgotten if this was the 30s or 40s, but a physicist named Dirac, and I forget his first name and nationality, but at that time, the physicists were aware of three fundamental particles: the proton, the neutron, and the electron. So things are pretty simple, and they also knew about relativity theory. And in a stroke of genius, Dirac put quantum mechanics and relativity together, and he predicted the fine structure in atoms, but basically some deviations from the simple calculations that were, I believe, already accessible by spectroscopy at that time. But so that was a good correction to a theory that was working pretty well. But then he realized, and I don't know how he did this in the math, but he realized, well, this theory actually predicts that each of the particles, proton, neutron, electron, should have an antiparticle with exactly the same mass and the opposite charge, and they should be able to annihilate each other or be created out of empty space. And sure enough, physicists discovered the positron, the anti-electron, 2 years later. So, wow. You do some work on paper and pencil, and they didn't have computers then. You just do that work, and you say, three more particles, exactly like that, and then confirmed. You could say, wow. You do that, you're really starting to think, we're beginning to understand this universe. And I'm pretty sure I'm pretty confident he received a Nobel Prize for that. But, you know, my other experience was, you know, so there, you know, you can, there's something awesome about that. But when I also remember when I was at, in the Berkeley graduate, you know, the Berkeley graduate physics department, we would have our meetings every, you know, a meeting bringing the whole, every, the beginning of every year, bringing all the physicists together. And at this point, actually, the generation of physicists after Dirac was, had become emeritus, and some of them were, you know, and were beginning to pass away. And so there was, and the Berkeley Physics Department is quite venerable, so they had, every year there'd be one or more, you know, often eminent physicists or their support staff who are essential and equally awesome in their own way, the people who make the machines. But they'd die, and then the chair of the department would have a moment of silence for them. But this is kind of an awkward moment of silence because, at least for me, I realized that, you know, as awesome as discoveries like Dirac's are, they don't touch the fundamental problem of death at all. If whether there's three or six particles, fundamental particles in the world, and there's maybe a lot more or a lot less, depending on what theory of physics you end up deciding on, all the physicists who come up with all the theories still die. And they haven't solved that problem. So, this is, yeah, that's, and, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I ended up, you know, coming here, where, you know, the Buddha took the problem of birth and death head on and solved it, at least for himself. But unlike, you know, unlike the discovery of the theory behind antiparticles, which you can just, anyone can now just read up in a book, and if you put enough time into it, you can understand it just as well as Dirac did. Even though you can't, it doesn't, birth and death don't work like that. They are, yeah, it's very personal, very visceral, and even though you can, you know, read about the Buddha's discoveries, unless you undertake the practice yourself, they'll just be words on paper. So that's what we're doing. And the Buddha recommended, yeah, deliberately and frequently bringing up recollections of death. And there were some recollections of death that he said would lead, when properly carried out, would lead to the deathless. One of the recollections that I don't think we've touched on yet this retreat is, there's a sutta where the Buddha says that before you go to bed every night, you should reflect that there are many causes, you know, from which you might die before the next morning. And he lists things like scorpions, snakes, centipedes, very, you know, diseases of bile and phlegm and wind. And so it was the sort of things one might die of in India at that time. We can substitute our own, even though it's actually one of the advantages about living out in the jungle is that, at least for practice, is that death is closer. Out at Dao Dum, you think well, yeah, a snake really could try to climb into my diem tonight, and that would be not so good. Here at Abhayagiri, somehow it seems safer, but in reality, you know, it's not. Or at least, I don't know, it's hard to tell. We have the danger of falling off the hill as we walk up and down every day. But still, to reflect on that. And then to think, well, if I were to die tonight, are there any unwholesome states that would be an obstruction for me? And I think the Buddha may list some. I've forgotten the list. But, you know, just one of them, you know, I mean, can think of, yeah, just greed, hatred, and delusion. Hatred is perhaps the one to start with, because it's one of the most obvious. If you're feeling hatred or ill will towards someone, that's something you want to drop before you die. It's not something you want to, take along with you. And yeah, similarly with greed, there's a whole lot of things to want out in the world. And we can get pretty tied up in wanting the newest this or that. Whether it be, and you know, it can range from everything from iPads to meditation states. But that sense of grasping, you know, if only I had that, things would be perfect. Though we rarely say that explicitly, but we sometimes are that deluded. But of course, it just keeps going and going and going, and eventually, you know, if you maintain that attitude, you inevitably die before you attain whatever perfection you were looking for by getting whatever you were looking for. And then also delusion, just the sense of identifying with this, identifying, I am the body, you know, this body is mine, or then also, you know, I am the mind, or this mind is me. That's one of the fundamental delusions. And again, death takes both body and mind away. And so if you're clinging to those things, it's not going to be easy. My first spiritual teacher, Sri Eknath Warren, his own spiritual teacher was, he recognizes this as his grandmother, even though, you know, and she taught him when he was basically too young to realize she was teaching him the skills he would need to go deep in meditation later on in his life. But she knew, or seemed to. She called him the King's Messenger, which is a strange title to give a child and teenager. But one of the and on the other hand, just like spiritual teachers, she was also kind of a bit merciless. You know, she saw potential, and so she would take young Eshwaran. His grandmother was the spiritual pillar of their family, and so every time someone in their extended family died, Eshwaran's grandmother would keep vigil, you know, that night, because no one else had the guts to sit with the body, is the story. But she made little Eshwaran sit vigil too, and none of his siblings. And he did not, you know, he liked his grandmother, but he didn't like that. You know, but it got him, and he saw painful deaths, and he asked his grandmother, why is death painful? Instead of answering, she said, okay, well, little lamp, which was another pet name for him, sit in that chair and hold on tight. And then she was stronger than Ashwaran at the time, and so she proceeded to yank him out of the chair. Ouch! Okay, sit there and don't hold on. And then she just pulled him out of the chair straight into her arms. She said, well, there you go. That's why death is painful. So that delusion. And yeah. Just contemplating the other teaching on mindfulness of death is the one that Ajahn Suchito talked about when he was doing, just to finish that first one off, the Buddha says if you find any things that would be obstructive if you died tonight, then exert whatever effort you can to eliminate them. And if they aren't there, then rejoice and continue to develop wholesome qualities. And then the sutta goes on to recommend the same procedure when getting up in the morning, reflecting that, well, you know, I could die today. And, you know, the same list of causes. And so again, reflecting, what's the state of my mind? Is there anything that would be an obstacle for me if I were to die today? So that's. And then the other teaching, and here Ajahn Suchito did such a much better job on that recording than I can do, but just that teaching that one develops mindfulness of death in a heedful way when one recollects, you know, if only I could live for the time it takes to breathe in after breathing out, or to breathe out after breathing in. If I were to live that long, I would be able to practice the Buddha's teachings to much benefit. That just complete immediacy. And again, focused on urgency in developing skillful qualities. And Ajahn Suchito, in that partially recorded talk, mentions, you know, walking back and forth at Abhayagiri and up at the elders' kuti and contemplating, well, what if there were no next step? Where does that assumption come from in my mind that there will be a next step? And that can, and sometimes that can really still the mind. And yeah, it's then looking deeply into this problem of being. Why is there a dilemma here? One topic that comes up is that of nutriment. There's the beginning, the very first of the novice's questions is, what is one? And the answer to that riddle is, all beings subsist on nutriment. which in a way is about as, it's about as significant, maybe even more so than Dirac's prediction of antimatter. Because the consequences of it, you can almost take it as a definition of what it means to be a being. You know, a being is something that craves nutriment. And it means that, in a way, it means that we're not passive observers of the world, which is sometimes what you can see from, you know, physics or other sciences, or even when it looks like quantum physics says you're not so passive, it's still very subtle, whereas this is very immediate. The way we see the world is shaped by what we want to eat, and you know, eating here is both physical food and mental stimulation. The standard list of the four nutriments are physical for the sustenance of beings who are about to take birth or for those who have been born, is physical food, gross or subtle, contact, which is the basic our experience of the world through the six sense media, the five senses in the mind, and then intention or volition, our urge to do things, we feed on that. And then consciousness, which is it's also defined in terms of the six senses, perhaps more subtle than contact. So this feeding is both physical and mental, and it means that we're looking for things, and that looking is. It shapes the way we see the world, and simultaneously it forms our sense of who we are. It brings us into potential conflict with other beings, because we either, you know, want to eat the same food, and you know, can't always, if I eat the food, you can't eat the food, or sometimes even, you know, you are my food. I know that happens too. It's really quite problematic. When I do walking meditation at night these days out by the book containers, there's a black widow spider which is living in one of the book, which is living in a piece of metal. It's a piece of metal that has an opening underneath. It's perfect black widow territory. This is the second black widow I've seen living there, and she comes out, and you know, they're frightened. They're kind of frightening and beautiful at the same time. I'm not too scared because I know they run away if you touch their web. It's curious that she doesn't, you know, my headlamp doesn't faze her at all. It's like she doesn't see it. I have no idea what that perception is. This bright light and it doesn't matter. Well, but I'm not a black widow, so I don't know. But what she is doing there is she's waiting for food to come along and stick in her web and so she can eat it. And I can see the excrement, you know, that's fallen down from her web. So I know she's getting stuff to eat, and she looks, you know, she's medium sized, not the biggest one I've seen. But, you know, and so with metta, and that's what I'm doing on my walking path. May all beings be well, you know. May everyone abide in well-being. May we abide in freedom from hostility. May we abide in freedom from ill will. May we abide in freedom from anxiety, and may we maintain well-being in ourselves. And it's a wonder. I mean, it's a beautiful heart-opening refrain. But I look at the Black Widow and I think, well, your well-being depends on insects wandering into your web, and that's not at all for their well-being. And so I think, well, in the case of spiders and insects, I'm afraid I really have to practice equanimity, because it's like, how can I take sides on the spider versus insect problem? You know, you can't. And you know, you recollect, right? Well, that applies to me too. You know, what I eat, other beings would like to eat. You know, it's, you know, whatever fields supply my food, I'm sure there's something living next to those fields who's either getting sprayed with pesticides or at the very least pushed out, and who'd like to live or have their offspring live in said field. But Kachana Bhikkhu's eating that, and so they can't. And one thing is, I use it as a reflection. You really want to try to make yourself as small as you can. And when you recollect, oh, right, that's a gift to other beings. I may not know them, but may they be well. You know, how can I reduce my impact? But at the same time, there's no way to eliminate the problem, because I really do need to eat. And, you know, sort of demonstrated this by accidentally losing almost 10 pounds over winter retreat. I wasn't planning on doing that, but Biba, who donates food, and Paul pointed out, you're getting thin. And I thought, so okay, whoops. Right. So, yeah, that's the problem of being, is that we need to eat. And there is very, one tries to, if one is wise and skillful, one tries to eat with as much skill as one can. But again, there's not a true solution to that problem. But where one can look in terms of figuring out what to do about the dilemma is at the craving. Because one craves nutriment, you know, and because of that one is sustained by that. And so one looks at, how do you remove craving? And it isn't easy, because, after all, we're defining ourselves by what needs the stuff we're craving. But the process is roughly that you find less harmful objects to crave and sustain oneself. And, you know, keep doing that and evaluating that, which is one way of looking at the Noble Eightfold Path. The Buddha, in one of his similes, likens the states of concentration, the jhanas, to increasingly refined levels of increasingly refined types of food for the soldiers of right effort and the gatekeeper of right mindfulness. And so this is, and yeah, meditation experience, you know, pleasant experiences in meditation really are nourishing in quite a deep way. They allow us to detach from, you know, much of the mental junk food we sometimes crave and eat. But, you know, even that still feeding. And and there's a teaching where the Buddha points out the path to the deathless to a monk named, I believe it's Pukkasati, and I may not have quite all the syllables right, but he's gone, he's heard about the Buddha and left the home life without ever seeing the Buddha, and they both end up staying in a potter's shed together. But he doesn't know that he's actually spending the night with the monk who he takes as his teacher. And the Venerable Pukkasati stays up most of the night practicing meditation, as does the Buddha. And after spending much of the night meditating, the Buddha is reasonably impressed by this monk. It's probably also encompassed his mind and realized, he's really meditating. Suppose I were to give him a teaching appropriate to his level. And so the Buddha points out some higher states to aim at. And then, in terms of moving towards more refined levels of equanimity. But then he goes on to point at the problem of and conceiving itself or conceit. So he points out, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be as a conceiving. I shall not be as a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form as a conceiving. I shall be formless as a conceiving. I shall be percipient as a conceiving. I shall be non-percipient as a conceiving. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient as a conceiving. And these are some of the destinations where Pukkasati's mind might get caught if he doesn't realize a higher wisdom. But still, this sense of I am is a conceiving. I am that is a conceiving. I shall be. So this whole sense of I am a being, I identify with things, and I have a future, is a conceiving. And conceiving is a tumor, conceiving is a dart, conceiving is a disease. When one overcomes all conceivings, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die, is not shaken, and does not yearn. For there is nothing in the sage by which he could be born. Not being born, how could he age? Not aging, how could he die? Not dying, how could he be shaken? Not being shaken, for what should he yearn? And so the whole notion of letting go of craving, that yearning, letting go of self-definition, not being defined by something, and then even though the body and mind continue, if there is no identification with them, that's how one eludes death, because there's no one to die. Or just to bring it back a little bit into more contemporary idiom, there's quote from Lumpur Sumedho. There is a sequence for the arising of right view. In other words, that okay. I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to get that one. So, nevertheless, I would urge everyone to continue the practice. Contemplate, bring up the contemplation of death, make sure it doesn't become too negative, and rejoice mightily and set your hearts where safety lies. So I leave this for your reflection. Namaste.